Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And we have a quick announcement. The persons that own the one-year chip and the 22-year chip have been found. They're in their room together. However, they do have the hearing devices in their room, so go get them. It's good to be out here. It's good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to be out here with you. There's a lot of friends here that I have, and it's always good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And now for the bill. I'm just glad to be off the plane. I flew in last night, and we were they wouldn't let me land. It let the plane land, but you know, I'm the only one on there. You know, and the guy said the Tampa airport has been closed, and there's a storm, and I'm just waking up from a little nap, kind of, and we're starting to bank, and I look at this powder blue water. And this guy's making this announcement, and it's starting to rain. And I said, "Christ Almighty, I'm gonna dive into the Bermuda Triangle." You know, I mean, I just had myself going down. You know, and we finally got off the plane, and it's good to be here. I had a hell of a ride to the airport. I'm driving along, and I'm kind of running late, and the glove box opens up, you know, so I slam it shut. And then it plops open again, so I speed up and slam it shut, you know. And it plops open again, so I turn the radio off, and I bring it up slowly, and then lock it. And it plops open again, you know. So I brought it up real slow and then slammed it. The idea of leaving the damn thing alone never entered my mind. I'm going to work on that thing till I get this thing done, you know, I turned the radio up and just, you know, I'm going 180 miles an hour, just, you know, just slamming that thing. As I stand here in Tampa, the car's parked over at the airport and the glove box is wide open. But I got a long ride home, and this time it's going to be different. I don't know about surrender. I don't know about surrender. I'm a loser. I'm a hostile loser. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for 20 years and not amount to a damn thing. He says I'm not much, but I'm all I certainly think about, you know, there they go. You know, I was frightened to death last night at the meeting. Somebody's beeper went out, and it sounded like one of my hallucinations. Scared the shit out of me, man. I thought, my God, you know. But I met some friends here. I met with Billy, and me and Billy took a walk today, and you just don't walk around the block with Billy. When you walk with Billy, it's going to be a two-hour deal, whether you like it or not, you know, and if it's not 2 hours, it will certainly feel like 2 hours, you know. And we were walking all over town, and he took me to the police department, and then we went to the bank and raised hell at the bank, and they had to fingerprint me to cash a check. It was just like old times, you know. Can we fingerprint you? I said, hell yeah. I'm all proud. Do the whole hand, you know. I mean, I'm clean today, you know. And so we got here. If you're new, I want to welcome you. I'm glad you're here. I don't have anything to get you to stay here or nothing like that. I can't make you stay here. Nobody can make you stay here. But I'm going to do what they did to me when I was new, and that's what I still see them do it today. Some people still do it. Some groups still do it. And thank God for this. I want to extend an invitation. I invite you to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous and make this ride with us. I invite you to come and apply these steps and get a home group and get on the journey of a lifetime. I invite you to do that. And I hope you're at the place where you're accepting invitations. I hope you're at that place that we all need to be, where there just isn't another option left. There just isn't another place to go. And secretly, I hope that maybe Alcoholics Anonymous will look like a step up to you. There's some people that they think that Alcoholics Anonymous is a step down. It's a little beneath them. And so they come what they get here for, and they get their material things, and then they're gone. You see? And we can talk about I am responsible, but what side of that hand do you want to be on? Are you always going to be on the taking side of that hand, or are you going to be the one whose hand is extended out? And I hope that you get on this journey, and I invite you to apply these principles to your life, because you're on a hell of a ride. One hell of a ride, you know. Like I said, I'm a hostile loser. I've always been a loser. I'm the type of loser that when I was growing up, they were always bringing people to my side to compare me to. My dad wouldn't, or anybody would say, well, why can't you be like that guy? Why don't you try to be like that guy? And I remember being in high school, and I was a freshman, and I got drunk, so I'm in the principal's office. And I'm sitting there with my dad, and in the principal's office is this picture of the star quarterback, old number 7. My dad says, well, why don't you try to be like Coy? I said, yeah. My sophomore year, I'm being arrested for being drunk and loaded on Reds. And I drove the janitor's cart right through the library door. I had to get that book back, you know. And so I'm sitting there with my probation officer and my dad. And my probation officer says, why don't you try to be like Coy? My junior year, my sister starts dating some guy and she brings him home. It's old number 7 right on my couch, man, you know. And my mom says, Jesus, honey, why don't you try to be like Coy, you know. My senior year, I'm in the Torrance jail. I'm getting ready to do 90 days. And I look, somebody slid a newspaper under there. And it says that Coy makes all pro CIF. And I said, Christ, I wish I could be like Coy, you know. And my sponsor says what goes around comes around, and lo and behold, I'm sitting at a stop sign in downtown L.A., and I'm in my van, you know, and I've got that look that I always look like I need help. People are always trying to save me. People are always stuffing envelopes in my pockets and little things, you know, and I'm on this, and it's vogue nowadays that if you're in Los Angeles or any place like that, there's these people holding these signs on every corner that said, I'll work for food, like you don't, you know. Sure enough, this guy locks eyes with me, man, and Jesus, you know. I've got $2 in my pocket, and I'm the cookie lady, and he ain't getting it, you know. And sure enough, he comes walking over to my van, and he sticks his head in the van. He walks over slowly, he locks eyes with me, and he goes, Larry? Larry Thomas? And I said, Coy! Jesus Christ! Yeah. I said, my God, I thought that guy had it made, you know. And I thought if there was any justice in AA, that maybe Bill or my sponsor could send this guy a letter saying, why can't you be like Larry? You know, But people have always looked like they've had it made to me, you know, and I come from a great home. My mom was a little Scandinavian lady, and I was born in Detroit. I was brought out to California when I was about 3 or 4 years old, brought up in a little foster home over there. And my mom was a Scandinavian lady, and she loved diet pills. My mom loved eating that speed. My mom was always buzzing around the house around midnight, sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage till sunrise, you know. And Jesus, what a busy lady, you know. And she loved to needlepoint. Oh, yeah, man. She'd be clicking and clacking all night long, you know, just putting out Afghans, you know. And everything in the house had an Afghan. The couches had Afghans. The chairs had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodles she knit, you know. And you'd go into the bathroom, and sure enough, the toilet paper had a little dog's head on it, you know, and my God, you know, and she was putting them out that night, you know what I mean? She got a hold of the edger one night and did the whole block, just took right off, you know? Just took off, man, her favorite thing was to eat that speed and put together jigsaw puzzles. Oh, yeah, not 3,000 pieces. 30 million pieces, you know, of the Sahara Desert, you know, she'd go down to the Rexall drugstore, getting a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because she bought, you know, she saved the coupons to buy more yarn is what she did, you know, hideous cycle she was caught up in. And she'd come home and put that stinky peroxide on her hair, you know, and get this. She owned one muumuu her entire life, you know, and it was shiny in all the wrong places, you know. And she'd come home and plop open that card table and start smoking Raleigh's, take a couple more Dexies, and start putting together this puzzle, you know. And she had a big pair of toenail clippers, because if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she's going to snip that son of a... You know, right? Oh, yeah. We're finishing it tonight. Oh, yeah. You betcha, you know. It'd be nothing to come home and have Mom move in the refrigerator by herself, because she's going to do some waxing, you know. And I'm a curious kid. I love taking things. I've learned to steal from my family and work out, you know, and I was always stealing things, and I'm about 7 or 8, and I'm in the kitchen, and I take two of those Dexies, and I don't think nothing about it, and I just start walking out in the backyard, just took off, man, like a rocket, you know. I just trying to beat my eyes into the next day, you know, and it's... I ran into the garage. I got scared. I closed the garage door down. I start putting together the PT-109, start sniffing that glue, you know, and looking out the window, and there was these black and white flashes, and that was the damn sun going up and down, you know. And I come out of there, open the garage door, and there's my mom in the backyard, and she's weeding dichondra. She's down there like a little gopher, you know, and I get right down there next to her, and we do the whole yard ourselves, man. Just... And I got two sisters. I got a younger sister. I got an older sister. And my younger sister stopped drinking in high school because she got a boyfriend. My big sister can't drink because it makes her sick. I keep telling her to hang in, you know, work through that. And they're in cahoots. I'm always in fights with them. They're always together. They're always pointing at me and laughing. You know, I grew up with this hideous complex that whenever two women are together, they're pointing at me and laughing. You know, I took an inventory with my sponsor, and I'm right. There's two right there. You know, just always fighting them. You know, and I'm 11 years old, and even when I was a baby, I was restless, irritable, discontented, whiny, pouty, throwing tantrums, and they called it colic. You know, hell, that stuff hangs in there for about 50 years. you know. Always had the edge on. Always had a little grind on. Always done exactly what everybody did around me. But I always knew that everybody seemed to grasp and develop a manner of living. Everybody seemed to be content with what they were doing. I've never been content with what I was doing. And I could do it well. I could do it good. I could play baseball, do all that normal stuff, and come home feeling empty. And around 11 years old, there's about four of us. We went across the street and we stole a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. Man, for the first time in my life, I felt together. It shut off that loud head. It took out the conversation in my head. Just the chittery-chattery and all the nicky-nacky woodpecker of my head just shut right up, man. And for the first time in my life, I felt good being sober. That was the first thing that I ever did that made me feel... It felt better than any home run I ever hit. It felt good in anything I'd ever done. And I knew I'd be leaning on that stuff for a long time, you know. And I didn't go to Skid Row the next day, but I did get the address, you know. And I always knew I'd be leaning on that stuff, you know. It just proved to me one thing, you know, that I knew that whenever I would get sober, I'd always feel lousy. And that was true. I had an awful feeling when I was sober. I drank because of the way that I felt when I was sober. Sobriety drove me to drink time and time and time and time again. I couldn't stand it, you know. And I knew I could take a shot of my old man's Thunderbird or go in the garage and find something. And it worked every time. And when I got into high school, I found a group of people who drank just like me and partied just like me. And it made me feel like this is the thing I was supposed to be doing, man. There's nothing like having people that drink like you. And man, there was that camaraderie and that love. And I found it, man. And I found it with the lowriders. And back in California, man, we get up our hair real big and we lower our Chevrolets, you know. Yeah, we drive around and we listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye, and God, I love it, man. I was in my plumbing truck the other day and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my damn truck. I loved it. I had a Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, and she curled up her hair real big, you know, and sometimes she'd use these soup cans to curl her hair, and sometimes those noodles are stuck in there, you know, and I'd get my hair up real big, and she'd get her hair up real big, and we'd bounce around all night drinking that gin, wondering what the hell you're staring at. What are you looking at? Oh, yeah, man, just driving around all night, man, ba-boom, ba-boom, you know, and I loved it, and everything I was doing in that car was working, man. Every now and then I'd take a look at myself in that rear-view mirror and I'd go, Jesus Christ, what are you doing in this car, man? My God, are you good looking. Jesus, what are you doing with these Mexicans, man? You could be an underwear model, you know? My God, man. You don't wear any, but what the heck, you know? I love the effect produced by alcohol. It turned Howdy Doody into James Dean in two drinks. I loved it, man. You know, and I leaned on it for a long time, man. And I thought that I found everything I needed in the back seat of that Chevrolet, man. I had my hair up real big. I had white T-shirts. I had black khaki pants that came up to here. You could see my hair before me when I turned the damn corner, you know. I had three guys in the back seat. They looked just like me. They had big frowns and big hair because their ass hurts too, you know, just bouncing around in that car, you know. I ran into a kid like that not too long ago. I'm over there in the Glendale Mall in Los Angeles. And a couple years ago, I'm in the Glendale Mall. This kid walks by me. He's got a bald head. Just shite. Sorry, Wayne. You know, just skinned alive. He's all tatted down. He's got a tank top on. He's got these big drawers that you could put about four kids in, you know. He's got three beepers because he's an important kid, you know. And I walk by him and his ear is chained to his lip, and his lip has got a ring in it. His nose has got a ring in it. They're chained together. I walk, and they're all chained to his wallet. And I said, for Christ's sake, it looks like a science project, you know. And I walk by him. He goes, what are you looking at? And I says, I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at. You know? What am I looking at, you know? Everything was hooked together. I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40 or something like that, you know. He opened his mouth. He had two ball bearings in there. I said, son of a bitch is going to start up any minute now, you know. What the hell's wrong with you, you know? And now I sponsor the guy. Yeah. Oh, well, what do you want me to do? I says, unlock yourself for Christ's sake, man. Jesus Christ, man, you know. Oh, I understand what that's about. It's about keeping them out, baby. It's about keeping them out, man. I spent a lifetime of keeping them out, man. Spike your hair and paint it red and put a safety pin through your nose or any other convenient place. It's all about keeping them out, man. Because if they get in, they're going to find out what we've been trying to keep away from people for our entire life, man. I am a weak, goofy nut. You can go ahead and complain all about my drinking you want. But once you find out that I'm secretly insane, I know you're going to get me. I couldn't stand the way that I thought. The way that I thought just hounded me, man, and it never changed, you know. But I could take a shot of alcohol and everything just comes together, man. And I'm not that frail, little, weak, terrified little boy, man, you know. But I bounced around out there for a long time, and everything I was putting in my system was working. And I loved it. I loved every minute of it, you know. Around 1969, all my friends are going places. Some of them are going to Vietnam. Some of them are turning hippie and going to San Francisco. And I thought, what am I going to do with my life now? So I thought, well, maybe I'll take my buddy and we'll go to Detroit and find my roots, you know. And we wound up in Phoenix. no roots there, just cactus, you know. And we're over there at the Apache Hotel up there, you know. It's about $40 a month. And one bathroom for 200 rooms, you know, and spent the evening staring at the wagon wheel bar, wondering how we can get in there, you know, and I met up with this guy, Ernie. Ernie's an idea man. I always have to hook up with ideas, man, because I don't have a clue about how to live, you know. I'm just drinking that old crow and old dreams, baby, you know, and Ernie says, Larry, he says, I know how we're gonna make some money. He says, not far from here is a horse track. He says, we're gonna get you down to 95 pounds and you're gonna be a jockey. And, all right, man, I'm into training, you know. And he says, now what we're gonna do? He says, I want you to take this stuff, and he has a bag of meth, you know. And he says, I want you to take this stuff, and you know, in 2 months we're gonna come back and weigh you in, you know. And he left, you know. And I'm just there with my little Kesslers going, all right, we'll see what we can do, you know. And 5 days later, he comes back, and I'm in the same doorway. I'm just, you know, Jesus, I don't want to be a jockey no more, Ernie. I'm going faster than any goddamn horse I've ever seen in my life, you know. And I'm about 95 pounds, you know. Everything's stuck together like that, you know. And when you get to that stage of your development, anything you drop on the floor is going to be smoke. Everything. I mean, you just raking it up, and when you go to fire it up, there's a big toenail in there. You're firing it up, you know. And, you know, he says, you couldn't have possibly done all that, you know. And so we had to get another idea, and I go to Volt or Manpower. I start working for this plumber. I hurt myself in about a week. I fake an injury. I go to the doctor. They get me a prescription for Percodan, and we start hooked up with these guys in Tucson, and we start drinking that Kessler's, and hooked up with these guys, start doing Social Security cards and writing prescriptions for Seconal and Tunal and Obitrol, you name it all. We wrote it all, you know. Damn near took it all too, you know. And I'm down in Tucson, and after about 2 years, they caught up with me. Now, when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase, you know. There he goes, down to 210, that son of, you know, it's just a matter of the sheriff coming into your room and going, there he is under there. You're all huddled up, frightened to come out, you know. And so they tried and convicted me and put me away for a couple years in Arizona, and I come out of there in 1974. And they met me with a $45 voucher and a bus ticket at the Continental Trailways to come back to Los Angeles. To come back to Los Angeles and go down to the court, and I hook up with the city officials and the probation department and all that stuff. And now what I'm doing in my sobriety is scaring me to death, because I can't stand the way it is beyond being paranoid. There is something going on with me that I can't put my finger on, and it's the most frightening place I've ever been, you know. And if you be an alcoholic and you're new, get yourself a sponsor and read that doctor's opinion. What a good place to start. What a great place to start. There's a place in that doctor's opinion where it says the only answer for us is entire abstinence. And then the immediate next paragraph, this starts a seething cauldron of debate. You bet. You bet. Well, why? Because we've been sober before, and abstinence has never been an answer. Abstinence has never been, and now they're telling me that I must be sober. If you be an alcoholic and you suffer from alcoholism, the idea of that you can't drink is not the big deal. The idea is that you will drink is the deal. You will eventually drink if you be alcoholic and suffer from alcoholism. We have the only disease that no matter what the circumstances, no matter what the wish, no matter what the frothy motion pill, no matter what the condition of your life is at that given moment, it is never enough to sufficiently stop you. That's how I related with Bill Wilson. It wasn't that he was a stockbroker or a Vermonter or none of that stuff or drank whiskey. It was that no matter what bottom he hit, he could never hit a bottom that could hold him in check. He could never get low enough to learn a lesson. There was nothing he could do to make him shape up. Because if he's like me or you, he hits that bottom, whatever it is, and it's just a matter of days, weeks, or months, baby. And that drinking it becomes the only idea. You push all your knowledge aside. You push your circumstances. You just go down, you got your liver in your drawers, and you're pounding for a half pint. I'm ready. Everything physically about you is ready to stop. And everything mentally about you is telling you, not this time. And you push it aside. Insanity for me is not being in these rooms and going blah, 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 and being goofy. Insanity for me is to stay in these rooms and apply these steps and believe to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic and I suffer from alcoholism and have that hideous idea that I could stay sober without you. That's total insanity to think that I could go out there and do that. Total insanity. And I couldn't understand that. I couldn't understand why is it, and then there comes that time when you do, when you're all for the idea. You're all ready for it. Yeah, Jesus Christ, this is the day. Oh, yeah, I got to stop. I'm all for it. And it's just a matter of hours, man. Nope. It's just a matter of hours before they're taking you to the Harbor General Hospital and you got hoses being pumped in you, and one more time the ambulance drops you off or something like that, and you're laying on the gurney and your only thought is, boy, when I get out of here, I'm going to Eddie's Liquor Store. How's that for social drinking? Now you make that go away. You see, I got the type of head that doesn't care that I'm sober. I got the type of head that doesn't care I'm in Tampa, Florida. We can hear all we want about it stop working, but my head don't care. My head could care less. In my mind, it'll always work. I'm an alcoholic. And if you're new and you're having drunk dreams, good for you. Good for you. Enjoy them. What are you going to dream about, burgers? And I couldn't understand it, but I knew it, you know. And when I'm sober and I'm taking this antabuse and all this stuff and I'm 2 months sober and I'm in a little league dugout like a frightened little deer, man. Just terrified. I get like that. And the lady comes and she calls the police and they come down and they start talking to me, you know, like I'm some kind of Martian, you know. All right, you're in California. It's going to be okay, you know. And they take me to the Harbor General Hospital and one more time they diagnose me. And they've seen that some of my drug overdoses have been suicide attempts, and maybe that I never need to go to a state hospital and be observed for 30 days. And they did. And they observed me for about a year. And I come out of that hospital totally observed, you know. And they told me the rumor that they tell all of us, that you won't be able to operate out there without some type of mood-altering chemical, antidepressant. And they were right. They gave me my bag, and they gave me a little shrink to go see, and I lasted 2 months, and I ran out of Thorazine, and they picked me up at over Alvaro Street. Got my little Thunderbird wine bottle over there by Alvaro Street, just shaking alone and afraid, and they arrest me for being a public nuisance, and they take me up to Wayside, and I'm up at Wayside County Farm again. About 30 days, they put about 60 of us, and they take us in a black and white bus, and they send us down to the county courthouse where I'm getting convicted and put away. And I'm in a little holding tank. They're just me and bologna sandwiches, and I'm wondering where I'm going now. Where am I going now? Everybody else is gone. And I'm in this little room at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. A little Scottish man with a patch stuck his head in a jail cell. And he said, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Come with me, lad. You're going to AA. AA? Those are two initials I've never heard of before. I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA, you know? And who's the Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? Aye, lad, you know? And, you know, I'm ready for a long ride and maybe some lunch or something, you know? And the guy takes me 6 blocks away to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for 15 minutes, he was your biggest cheerleader. For 15 minutes, he talked you up a storm. For 15 minutes, he did what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about what we used to be like and what we're like now and what has happened. And he was so glad I was going to see you. And he made it very clear that if there was anybody in that car to be doing some changing, it wasn't going to be him. You see, he could have did that nonsense that they do today when they get newcomers. He could have lowered his car and pierced his face and talked that jailhouse street nonsense to make me feel a part of, but he didn't. He was a man of principle. He had given up his rights and took on some principles, and he talked a totally different language. He talked from the heart, and he talked about a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he just popped my bubble. He says, "I know you feel different, but," he says, "I need you to know this." He says, "The more different you feel, the more qualified you are." And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975, a little Alano club over there in Torrance. A TLC club it's called. He introduced me to a little lady named Indian Jeannie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people. My God, I just left a group of people like this, you know. Everybody had a nickname and a tattoo, you know, and they wanted to get their cup on the wall that day or some nonsense, and little Moose come running down the hallway like a toilet paper commercial after me, you know. She go, "Hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are." I ain't it. I'm not no miracle, you know. And then this transvestite came out of the card room, and he circled me like a helicopter for about 3 times, you know, and he said, "I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." I said, "I don't think so." Not for my first year anyway. Nice dress, though, you know. And I said, "My God, if that's AA, I don't want to stay in here, you know. And if that's the effect of that blue book, I'm not sure I want to crack that thing open either, you know." and I immediately got out of there, you know. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, and 60 days and get drunk, and 90 days and get drunk, and the longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was on heroin. And that's the biggest lie that I've ever told myself, was that I was coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Biggest lie I've ever told myself. And I don't. And doing that does not make me a better member or a worse alky. Do that. The only thing that did is just render me defenseless. All that thing did is just prove to me, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that my way don't work in combination of anything. That if I don't apply myself to this simple program, I will be left to my own devices. I had no defense. I sat in here for an hour and a half hour before meeting time, I put my AA face on. Half hour after the meeting's over, I took my AA face off. I sat here, got physically sober and mentally ill, like tons of people we watch. You know? And in 1978, there's a guy doing his 12-step, you know, and in 1980, there's a guy doing his 12-step work. And I'm up there in a little room in Wilmington. I got a hot plate and a hot TV. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm watching Jeopardy so I could really feel like an idiot, you know. I got a half pint of bourbon cut in half. I got my long hair and my old clothes, my little lawn chair, you know, and I hear this, "Larry, it's Don. Can I come in?" I go, "Oh, my God, it's that guy from AA. I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here," you know. And he opens up the door, and he goes, "Oh, my God." He goes, "Larry, you had 15 days. You're going to be a janitor in the city of Lomita. There's some hope for you new guys," you know. And he says, "What's going on here?" You know. And I told that guy off all the honesty. I says, "Don," I says, "you've been trying real." I started feeling sorry for this guy. I thought I was letting this guy down, you know. And he said, no, "Hang on a minute, pal. You being drunk don't shock me. If you be an alcoholic and you don't apply this way of life to your life, you're going to be drunk or dead. There's no options here. So you being drunk don't shock me." He said, "If you want to shock me, go to work. That'll shock me, you know." And I took another drink at him, you know, and I told him, "Don," I said, "you've been trying real hard, but I don't want what you got and I don't want what you have. And if I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do, but just get the heck out of my room and let me do what I want to do." The cry of this alcoholic for my entire life: "Let me do what I want to do." We all have a cry because we still yell it once we get sober. "Let me do what I want to do. Nobody's going to tell me what to do." And the moment that I said that, it struck a chord in the back of my neck, shot me back down to 1967 when my dad's kicking me out of the house because I'm caught drunk and selling dope at high school. And he said, "You want to live that way, you go do it under your own roof. I got a wife and two daughters." And I did. If there was a man that I hated my entire life, it was my father, because he reeked of the way that I should have been living. He reeked of responsibility. My old man was a World War II vet. My old man was a fine man. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it became worthy of me, became worthy and most important to me to start calling the old man father. My dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy, singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. My old man was always sneaking in and out of his own home. He was a window climber, you know. Always, I could always see the old man on the gas meter around midnight trying to get into his own home, you know. And I remember him sneaking in my bedroom one night because I could feel his refinery boot on my chest. I said, "Hey," I said, "why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys? Hell, she's up anyway, you know. I mean, I spent a lifetime trying to get my father's approval. I spent a lifetime wanting my dad's approval. But I stopped doing the things to get it when I was about 12 years old and wanted it anyway. My old man would be there for me. All I had to do was ask. But you see, he brought up his kid brother by himself. His father died when he was 10, hung himself. His mother killed herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And he brought up his kid brother doing side jobs. And the old man had a dream. He hooked up with a young lady who was 15 years old. And he went into the Navy, and that was my mom. And they had a dream. They were going to come to California after the war and live the good life. And the old man had a dream. And I became a nightmare of that dream. I felt so unworthy of my father and mother's love that I couldn't recognize it. I spent my entire life trying to feel special. I spent my entire life doing average things expecting standing ovations. I spent my entire life just doing regular things expecting parades for taking out the trash. I go to work for 8 hours and I think the boss is in the office going, Jesus Christ, man. They just don't make them like that anymore, you know. My God. And you only took a half hour lunch, too. Boy, they don't make them like that, you know. Always having to feel special for doing what I'm supposed to be doing anyway. And isn't it just like me to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, make a pot of coffee, and think I'm going to be in the grapevine? I put a toilet seat on for my wife 2 months ago. I waited 3 weeks for her to notice it. Every night she'd come home from that meet, and I'd be up, all right, she's got to look down there sometime. My God, how selfish can you be, Rosie? Can't you see that piece of wood you're sitting on? You know, my God, I just had to tell her, you know. She goes, oh, yeah, I noticed it 3 weeks ago, you know. What a great lady she is, man. And the moment that I said that to that guy, let me do what I want to do, struck a chord in the back of my neck, like I told you. It reminded me of that guy coming out of that institution in Arizona. And where do macho men go when there's no place to go? They go to mom's house. The macho lowrider's on his mom's house, and he sneaks into his mom's house, and it's about 1 o'clock, and I've got my street mud on. And people who live on the street know what that's about, because it grows from the inside out. I sneak through a little window, and I sit down with my mom. I'm frightened half to death. She's terrified, and she's afraid, and I'm sitting next to her. She puts my head on her lap, and she starts rocking. And she's saying, Dear God, help my baby boy. And I can feel her tears hitting my cheek. And I'm saying, Mom, it ain't that bad. You see? It ain't that bad, Mom, for me to crawl out of a carport and then go across the parking lot to where you work in that dry cleaners. And I can see you watching me for a block as one more time the thing comes out of the gutter to go strolling over to his mom to beg for a dollar, to see her open her little purse and get out that hard-earned dollar at the dry cleaners and give it to me. You see, it doesn't bother me to do that. But boy, asked me to get a commitment in a meeting. Oh, Jesus Christ, is that a bother? See, I can do that to my mom, but I can't go to the secretary and say, do you have any commitments in your group? You see, that's what I'm talking about here. That's what I'm talking about here. And all that went by my head is the only answer to life I've ever left that room, that bald-headed carpenter. And from 1980 to 1982, I'm stuck with the memory of you, and I can't get you out of my mind. And I'm living on the streets, and I'm hoping I can die on the streets, and I'm caught in that thing where getting drunk and staying sober feels the same. It's just that one has an odor, you know? And in May 2nd, 1982, I go by a Woolworth window, and I see the thing, and the thing's and he's 120 pounds, he's yellow. He's got his rented clothes on. He's got his long hair. And I look into that thing and I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman. How come I'm always getting drunk and I'm always getting sober? What's going on? And I did what I always do when I got that way. I stuck out my hand and panhandled some money and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I called Alcoholics Anonymous and who do I get? I got Don. Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the mission down here in Wilmington. I'm ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. He says, you want to get sober, get your rusty rear down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after you. He says, my sign says we care. Doesn't mean I'm going to take care of you. And he hung up. And I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love that guy had, you know? And I took the longest walk of my life from Wilmington to Torrance, about 9 miles. And I walked up to that little Alano club that I'd been thrown out of. And I had my little poopy pants and my dirty clothes on. And I waddled up to there. And there's about 4 guys standing out front. And they're all pointing at me and laughing, you know. And they said, what do you want, Larry? And I said, well, if it interests you, I said, I'm looking for Don. He says, well, he's on the inside over there in the club. But you better get out of there after a half hour. And I waddled up to that guy. And I asked him something I never asked a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And the guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds. And then he lit into me for about 20 minutes. And he told me, he gave me the wood. He told me under no certain terms that he's going to put up with my nonsense. He said, you make the effort, I make the effort. You don't make the effort, forget it. I got guys that want to do this thing. I don't got time to be chasing after you. And I stayed there all day, and he gave me some direction to do. You know, and I stayed there that Thursday day, and I stayed all day, and they gave me honey and orange juice. And I shook it out, and I puked it out, and I rubbed shoulders with the drunks of Alcoholics Anonymous. For the first time in my life, you were selling sobriety, and I was buying. For the first time in my life, I wanted what this program had to offer. For the first time in my life, it looked like a step up. For the first time in my life, whatever you were doing, I wanted to be part of it. For the first time in my life, I wanted to do whatever you folks were doing, because if there was one thing that I couldn't deny, even though I didn't like you and I didn't like your nicknames, you were doing something that I'd never been able to do. You were staying sober and you were happy about it. And if you're new, that's what's happening with me right now. I am happy to be sober. And those two words don't belong in the same room at the same time with a guy like me. I've never been happy about being sober. It's always been restless, irritable, and discontented, and always followed by more misery and more depression. But if you're new, I invite you to a program of Alcoholics Anonymous where all that will be put aside. And I stayed there, and that guy, and at that Thursday night meeting, I stood up and I said, my name is Larry Thomas, I'm an alcoholic, and for the first time in my life, I felt like a member. And at the end of the meeting, the guy was going to take me back to the mission, and my sponsor says, you're coming home with me. I said, well, this is sponsorship, you know. And we're driving up there, you know, and I'm thinking I'm going to sleep in his den, and, you know, I'm smelling waffles already and stuff like that, And he pulled up to his garage, and he had abandoned Toyota over there, you know, it was on blocks, you know, and he says, get out of there and get into that damn car. And I said, take me back to the mission, you know. He said, no. He says, you're sleeping in there tonight. And he says, if you get out of that car, I'm going to have you arrested. And he slammed the car, and I'm stuck in this little Toyota. And he come running back, and he opened up the car door, and he says, oh, while you're in here, hotshot, he says, you better find a God. And he slammed the door again. I said, whatever happened to the love this guy had, you know? I said, I'm in a Toyota. Where am I going to find a God? In the glove box, you know? Maybe in the visor or something like that, you know? And after about 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm staring out the window and I'm watching the trees breathe, you know, and I'm hearing all that music, and thought came to me that I may have a ton of drunks left, but I never want to be new again. There is nothing neat about being new. I don't ever want to. I will do whatever this bald-headed carpenter tells me to do just so I don't have to be new again. There's nothing. I will go to Tampa just not to be new, you know? And I followed that guy, and that was my sponsor. He was my first sponsor, and he loved me, and I loved him real good. And for a year and a half, I followed that man around. And for a year and a half, he had me busy. And I felt the love that a man has for another man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt that connection that you feel with your brothers and sisters here. If you're new, I urge you to get a sponsor. But more important, get yourself about 2 or 3 people you can call your friend. Get yourself about 2 or 3 people that you can talk to about your sponsor. You know? See if that son of a bitch is telling them the same thing, you know. You know what he did last night? Yeah, me too, you know. There's nothing like having some riding buddies, man. There's nothing like the spirit of being in that car with your buddies on the way to a meeting, man. There's nothing like bouncing in that car on your way to a meeting, man, and you're talking that AA stuff and you're in the spirit, man. And before you know it, the miracle of miracles are going to happen. And that's what I love about being with you guys is the spirit starts when we're together, but there's nothing like getting cleaned up for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing like the feeling I get when I start showering and getting ready to come see you. There's nothing like cleaning in from the inside out and getting cleaned up for your AA. Anybody can come to a meeting in their plumbing clothes. But man, when you start making these little efforts, man, you're making these little efforts for a big, big thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved it. I started seeing myself doing little actions like that, you know. And you don't have to worry about the arguments about your spouses thinking, oh, you know, I'm second best. I don't like being a backseat to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is some of the beef that I hear. My little wife, Rosie's got 10 years sober. It's my privilege to be in a back seat to her AA. It is my privilege to be second or third on the list of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm on there, man.
Because when you love Alcoholics Anonymous and it becomes a way of life, there's nothing like being there. There's nothing like watching your mate go off to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing like it, because you know what it's like after 2 days and they ain't gone to a meeting. 2 days is too much. Oh, yeah. 2 days is too much, man. I get that chainsaw after her, you know. Take out the trash, your ass. Whoa, you know? Oh, yeah. And after a year and a half, I started backing off from my sponsor. After a year and a half, I become something in that club in my own mind, because people are telling me what you used to be like and what you're like now. You're really something, and I start believing that nonsense. After a year and a half, I start holding these secrets on, and I start backing away from my sponsor. I start judging them. I become bigger. My ego becomes bigger than my meeting. And now I'm 2 years sober. And I'm sober, and I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. And we're thinking homicide and suicide, and nothing is the answer. That god-awful complacency in Alcoholics Anonymous, the cancer killer of the sober member, that complacency where everything around you is burning up and you want to buy furniture. That complacency in Alcoholics Anonymous, where you're self-satisfied with your life while you're in the midst of danger. And then I'll be sitting next to my sponsor. I'll never forget this. The guy just nailed me. Old guy by the name of Charlie Vick. 1987, I'm sitting in this meeting, and I heard it. My sponsor's a nudger. Johnny's a nudger. Every time he hears something, we're nudging, man. And I'm sitting next to the old man, and Charlie Vick says, "The obsession to drink will never come as a form of a drink. The obsession to drink will always come as another form of, I don't need to do this. I'm too busy for this. I've been sober too long to do this." And that's how the cancer begins. That's how the backing out begins. I don't need to make coffee anymore. I don't need to call the sponsor. I don't need to go to so many meetings. And if you knew, watch these people in AA. Watch your brothers and sisters. They're telling you the book. They're showing you that book. They're showing you what works and what doesn't work. And watch these people get up and take their cakes, and they thank you for their blessings. Oh, I've got my degree back, and I've gotten my family back, and I've gotten this incredible job back. Now watch these people like a hawk. Most of them, 80% of them, will start hanging themselves with their great blessings. Watch them as they start yanking themselves out of Alcoholics Anonymous and kicking the box right from under them, because they spend more time working on their blessings than coming back to the place that taught them how to be blessed and what blessing is all about. See, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get nothing. It was my turn to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and start giving. And if you're new, your days of getting are over with, because Alcoholics Anonymous is going to do to you what you've been doing to people your entire life. We're going to use you. Be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, you know. You betcha. And there they go now. There goes our cleanup crew. And at 2 years sober, I'm sitting in that meeting, and whenever, and it happens, I'm sitting in that meeting, and a man come there, and he told me, he says, "You know, there's a unity in Alcoholics Anonymous, Larry. It's called Unity, Service, and Recovery. There's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hope you find it, kid." That's all the guy said, and I followed that guy. I followed that guy to my 2 years sober, to my first home group. I didn't know you guys hung out together. I didn't know about home groups. I just know about coming to that club and getting up in the middle of the speaker, and, you know, I don't know about courtesy and getting commitments. I didn't know about getting jobs in me. My home group, I love my home group. He taught me about love for a home group. He didn't talk to me about sitting in that chair and sitting on my hands and don't drink unless your ass falls off, and 30 days later come back, no ass, you know. You taught me that if I want to feel a part of this power called Alcoholics Anonymous, grab a mop. There's great power comes out of that mop. He says, "You don't have to wait for a power. Start joining us and become part of the great power of Alcoholics Anonymous. Become part of that power." And he taught me about the love and respect for a home group. I love my home group. My home group is the Bellflower Big Book Group of Bellflower, California. It's a Monday night speaker meeting. Yeah. And I love that group. I love that group because you taught me about the importance of love and respect for a thing that's saving my life. I don't wear this tie because I'm sharp and effective. I wear this tie because you taught me how to get one. You taught me how to go out and get a job and earn a living and look decent for the thing that's staying. Because if I can't wear my best for you, what good am I? I could come here with my plumbing clothes on and don't make any effort, but you guys made great efforts for me. You come to your meetings when you don't want to. You come to your meetings when kids are crying and when you know you should be home, but you still sit in those meetings and you put them up and you make coffee for a guy like me to come in and say, hey, would you be my sponsor? My responsibility is not so much to put my hand out, but to make sure that I can recreate the atmosphere that was created for me. See, we create an atmosphere that in nowhere, shape, or form has ever been created before. Me and you together in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, we create an atmosphere where the unwanted come in and they feel wanted. Where you do the uncomfortable to get comfortable. And you love the unlovable and you feel the most things that ever you ever dreamed of start happening in your life. I love my meeting of our, and I have commitments in my home group because it's my home. We have greeters at the door. We welcome you. We find you a seat. And at the end of the meeting, we thank you for coming. And if I brought you into my home today in Lakewood, at the end of the evening, I wouldn't say, hey, would you stay and help me clean the bathroom? That's my home. I take care of my home group so that people like you and your guests, you could come in and let me be of service to you. What a great atmosphere for a guy to be coming in and wanting to stay sober. Anybody can come into a little club at the gloom and doom meetings, you know. Don't drink the liquor, ass. I ain't drank for 40 years. I bet you haven't, pal, you know. But when you come into an enthusiastic group of Alcoholics Anonymous, man, you thrive on that enthusiasm, you feed from it, and get with a bunch of people that are doing the thing, because we're in herds. We do what we're around. Because when that guy's feeling crappy, you can take him to a meeting. And when you're feeling crappy, he can take you to a meeting. But at least you're going to the same place. Talking about the same thing, doing the same actions. Unity in Alcoholics Anonymous isn't how many people we can pack into a room. That's chaos. Unity is how many people we can put in this room and do the same thing for the same reason. My common welfare depends on me doing what you teach me to do. My common welfare demands that I do what people around me are doing. And these people in Tampa, Florida have created an atmosphere this weekend. From the old timers down, you people have done one heck of a job because you can feel the enthusiasm in this room. You can feel it at this convention. And if you're new, I invite you to take part of that. I invite you to get part of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hooked up with that sponsor, and my sponsor's Johnny, and I love my home group, and we got into that inventory, and we started making amends. And I got my mom and dad off the hook. I got my mom and dad off the hook. And I started hugging that little mother. And I started resting her head on my lap with her emphysema. And I started rocking. And she could feel my tears as they hit her cheek. As I said, dear God, please be with my mom. The men in Alcoholics Anonymous whose hands that I sweep with and mop with, I hold at the end of every meeting. And we say the Lord's Prayer. And because I'm used to touching men and kissing men on their birthdays and men hugging me when they're done speaking and sponsoring guys and having a sponsor hug you and kissing you on your birthday, that because of little actions like that, that the past 2 years of my father's life, I got to be there for that guy. I got to clean him. I got to take care of his bills. And when I opened that door to his little apartment, that little 200-pound refinery worker was down to 80 pounds, and he had his bald head and his Dodger hat on. I could come in there, and I didn't talk about my disease or his, but we got to laugh. I got to take the old man up and clean him up and take him to a Dodger game. I got to take that old man out for rides up to the coast and stuff like that. And that guy became my best friend. And every night I would see him, and every evening I would see him, I would kiss him on the head, and I wasn't ashamed of it because I was a man. I was proud of it because I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there was men kissing me when I wasn't worthy of it here. There were men holding on to me, and you held me real good. You held me up real good. We hunkered together here and created this thing called the love of Alcoholics Anonymous. When we're together, we create a spark. And when your spark and my spark hits, there's a power there that can't be recreated anywhere else. Now, what are you going to do with a guy like me? I don't know nothing. I didn't come from nothing. I'm not used to holding a job. Alcoholics Anonymous made me a plumber. They stuck me, they took me right out of the gutters and stuck me in the sewer, for Christ's sake, is what they did. And I'm a good plumber. I'm an honest plumber. You know? I work for one of the biggest chemical companies in the world, and I do all their plumbing for them and stuff like that. And after 5 years of marriage, I was driving down the street, and there was a home that I could see my wife in. You see, I know I'm in love with my wife because she's the first woman that I tell other women about. She's the first woman that makes me proud that I'm loyal. She's the first woman that I never wanted to hurt. See, it's my privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's my privilege to have a wife like her. It's my privilege to have principles today, you see. And my mom's used to visiting me in a little hole or sliding me mail into it, and my mom visited us at a little home that I bought for me and my little wife. And my mom was frightened and she was scared and she brought a little rubber tree and she sat in the backyard of this house. And it ain't nothing fancy, a little 50-year-old house in Lakewood. And she says, you know, all I ever wanted for you to do was be happy and live a good life. And my, don't we do that here well. You see, I used to think I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous and it shield me from life's little bullets. But what it does, it puts you smack dab in the middle of life and you better have a program because they don't care. They just want their ditch dug. But you come in here and you hunker real close to us. And you get that sponsor and you apply these steps to your life and great events will come to pass. Get your house in order. That's what that sponsor is for. Get your little house in order. The answers will come to your life if your house is in order. Everything you need to make you happy will be given to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything that hinders that happiness will be removed by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Your days of searching are over. You're here. I invite you to stay. Bill Wilson once said that my heart panteth after the water brook, but my soul panteth after you, dear God. I don't know about panteth. I know about craving. I know that this is a fellowship that I crave. And I know that every time I'm with you, I am in God's hands. And thank you for not letting me wiggle out. Thank you.